Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Steve Buckley with Open Government Radio. Sorry, I had a little problem there. Disconnected myself. In any event, let's see. I'm just making a technical check here to see if I have one of my guests on, just to see if I'm live. Jim, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. I inadvertently disconnected myself just as I was calling in, so just wanted to make sure that this was working and all fine. Okay, I'm going to make some announcements first, and then we will come back to you and also Lucas Gioppi, who will be joining us, who I believe is also calling in. But hold on a second, and I'm going to make some announcements. Yes, this is the Open Government Radio Show for April 6th, 2010. And the best way to follow along is to go to go to ustransparency.com, and there you will see the more details about today's show, which, as if you go there, it's about spotting holes in the open government plans. And those are the plans that will be coming out tomorrow on April 7th. Each federal agency is required under the Open Government Directive to come out with a plan to show how they're going to become more transparent, more participatory, and more collaborative. And so anyway, if you do go there, you will see that. I just want to go quickly down the list of some links there. We may be coming back. We'll probably be coming back to a lot of these. But as you can see, you can scroll down and see that our guest today is J.H. Snyder, who has written a paper in the special issue of the International Journal of Public Participation. And there is a link to that issue along with a link number one, which shows you a link that's Deterring Fake Public Participation, and that's the title of J.H. Snyder's paper there. But I do want to do a few announcements, and they're related to the other links, which if you scroll down at ustransparency.com, you will see there's a link to previewing agents. Number two is previewing agencies' open government plans. Lucas Gioppi represented the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation at a conference last week that was held at the White House Conference Center. And he'll be filling us in on that is a link to his blog post, but we can ask him some additional questions. Number three, what government plans are missing is a blog posting by Andrea DiMaio. Participedia.net was a cool website that I came across. It's like a wiki, and it contains all kinds of participatory methods and also organizations, which in the large part, I think are operating below the radar screen of the general public and the popular media. Also, on April 17th, on the next link down there, number five, you'll see that Participation Camp will be coming up April 17th and 18th, which is a Saturday and Sunday. Not this Saturday and Sunday, I guess that's the next one. But anyway, you've got a calendar. Also, the Open Government Directive Workshop, which is number four in the series. Lucas Gioppi is the main organizer for that, and I'm sure he'll be able to tell us a little bit more about what's going on there. That's coming up on April 28th, and that will be held at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also, link number seven is, the Memorandum on Transparency and Open Government that the president issued on his first day in office, which begot number eight, the White House Open Government Directive, which came out this past December. And then interesting thing we might touch on this is that the Coffee Party, which some people may think of as the anti-Tea Party, is not really that at all, at least in my opinion. If you go there to their site, you'll be able to see that they really are primarily focused on promoting civil discourse and creating a new age of participation. And then, of course, there's the Open Government Directive Google group, which is a moderated email group. You can opt in, opt out, if you don't want to get any more information and so forth. There's a link there, and I am the moderator for that group, so you don't have to worry about getting a whole bunch of junk mail. But definitely the email traffic will be picking up, I'm sure, with all these open government plans coming out. And I just came across something a minute ago, literally, that link number 11 is a blog posting by OMB Watch, unnamed author, but it does provide a lot of details about what to expect tomorrow when the open government plans come out. So, okay, now we'll go back up, and I think what I'll do is we have Lucas Chiaffi. I think I'm going to, I told Jim, I think we'll lead off with Lucas telling us a little bit more about, in a nutshell, what what he got out of the conference last week, and at the White House Conference Center with the preview of the Open Government plans, and then we can get into more specifically what to expect in those plans and how what might be look for, what might be missing in a plan, and what. And what might be construed as weak or fake public participation, something that's trying to be presented as public participation, but it's really not the case. So we'll do that first. I'll unmute. Let's see. Is that Lucas? Are you there?
Hi, Steve. I'm here.
Okay. It sounded a little better than yesterday.
Great.
Good. Yeah, like I said, we'll start off with you, and then we'll turn to Jim Snyder and talk about his paper. But and like I said, there's a link there which would be on the U.S. Transparency. I guess let's see, that would be link number two, previewing agencies' open government plans. And if people do click on that, they'll be able to read the whole thing. But rather than read it to them, is there anything, an overview or in a nutshell of what people might be looking for or should expect or not expect from agencies that isn't hasn't been passed around a lot? I know you did a very good blog posting here, and I tell people to read it, but go ahead and share with us what you got out of going to that conference.
Well, the one thing that impressed upon me the most was that the teams are quite excellent, that the people that are working on the plans behind the government firewall, the people that we can't see, are actually quite outstanding. Sometimes, I was in the Army for 5 years, and I've seen when folks are assigned a mission that they're not too thrilled about, that subordinate commander will put on one of his lower-ranking soldiers and kind of just check the block. But I was able to see the OMB team, Treasury, DOT, Department of Housing and Urban Development, HHS, and Office of Science and Technology Policy, and just across the board, they were all very impressive teams. Some agencies were further along than others, but all of them seemed to do a great job. The most reassuring part was the team that they had gathered, the personnel. Those were the right folks. They were highly enthusiastic, if there was one thing that was evident, was the enthusiasm, which won't be apparent when the paper reports come out. It's just that there's a whole lot of enthusiasm inside the government on these teams, and it was honestly very surprising. I didn't think that there would be this groundswell of support. It just seems like a huge initiative, but I think that whatever they had to do to get it done, they got it done inside, and I look forward to seeing the full reports when they come out tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And I know in your blog posting, you mentioned that, everyone emphasized that their open government plan is version 1.0, and they won't get it absolutely right the first time, and they will be continually improving their plans. So even if whatever comes out tomorrow, I guess everybody needs to keep in mind that it's not written in stone. And they will be open to, supposedly, open to comments, so they can come out with 1.1.
Every team did emphasize that this is just the first version and that they will be seeking continual improvement. Some of the agencies are meeting with their secretaries all the way at the top of their agency on a quarterly basis to review the open government plans, to talk about necessary changes. And I think as folks in the private sector and nonprofit sector, we should definitely be helping by providing constructive criticism and helping them continue to improve these plans. You know, I think that it's going to be very hard to improve plans once they're written down, but they do have the right attitude that these are just the first version. There was one criticism that from all the other nonprofits and folks in the private sector that were gathered there, and they said it would have been wonderful to view these plans ahead of time before April 7th in draft format, perhaps a few weeks ago, but that wasn't possible. Perhaps it's a little bit too much of a culture change. The good news is that they do recognize these versions that are published on April 7th still are the first draft. So we should hold them to that, and we should also help them with the second version as they come out.
Mm-hmm. Constructive criticism. Always in the constructive way. I mean, but certainly you have to figure out if things are missing, of course, then that also can be constructive too. Well, like I said, people can go to that link and read what's going on. Is there anything, like I had given a plug for the Open Government Playbook and Participation Camp. Is there anything that you wanted to throw in for those plugs before we move on to heftier matters?
Great. Well, I'll just two more points to summarize up from those meetings last week. Office of Management and Budget talked about the deliberative process that they use internally with the agencies, and they said that when they're deliberating about the budget, it's not possible to talk about the data upon which they're deliberating. But interestingly enough, they did mention they will be sharing their deliberative process. So although we can't talk about the throughput through that process, we can talk about improving that process. And because process drives product, indirectly, the participatory community will be able to improve the federal budget, which I thought was very exciting. There was a lot of exciting data that was going to get published. Department of Health and Human Services had just a great brief. I was spectacularly impressed with them. And they also mentioned they're going to be creating a community of practice of folks that are interested in not just transparency and data, but also civic participation. And we look forward to seeing what comes out there. You asked about the Open Government Directive workshop. So we have the fourth one coming up in the series. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is hosting it on the morning of April 28th here in Washington, D.C. It's going to be another outstanding event. The few changes that we've made to it, we've shrunk it down to just a half day so that more higher-ranking people can come back, because it seems like folks were saying these are great workshops, but they leave us far behind if we miss a whole day of work. So we'll give the people what they want, and we'll cut them down to half a day so they can get right back to work and not get too far behind on emails. The other note of change, now that the federal employees have really started moving at a very rapid clip here, we're going to the workshop is going to be driven only by the federal employees. So public sector is going to determine what questions and challenges we're going to address in the workshop. We're going to be opening it up 2 weeks prior online using GovLoop and the discussion forums there. And then for those 2 weeks, we'll be discussing and fleshing out some of these issues, proposing possible solutions to challenges. And then we'll have the face-to-face event, as I mentioned, April 28th. And then we'll sum everything up on the wiki. There's going to be almost a moral obligation for people to take notes, because we don't want to have the same conversations from month to month. We want to make sure that we're building on the conversations we had the previous month. And if anyone wants to find out more information about it, they can go to opengovplaybook.org, and they'll find information about the workshop series. Once again, that's opengovplaybook.org.
I don't know if I put a link there. Did I put a link even? No. Oh, no, I didn't put that in. Usually I do. But anyway, yes, opengovplaybook.org. Easy to remember. So very good. And are you involved with Participation Camp? Are you one of the organizers of that too?
I'm just assisting in the background with some of the logistics. Wayne Burke from the Open Forum Foundation has jumped out and taken the lead. Participation Camp is going to be held at the George Washington University on the 17th and 18th of April. And picking up where Transparency Camp left off, it'll be rounding out the open government discussion on civic participation. So moving the ball forward from data transparency to participation. Once again, that is April 17th and 18th. And the link is participationcamp.org.
Right. And that is also for people listening, that they can find that at link number 5 at ustransparency.com. And fine. Okay. Well, then I think we'll turn to Jim Snyder and talk about his paper and how, you know, and what we should, how that is related to what we should be looking for in the open government plans when they come out tomorrow. And when I say when they come out tomorrow, someone reminded me that that might be close of business tomorrow, or maybe even mid 11:59 p.m. I'm sure that some of the agencies are working on them as we speak, and getting dotting the I's and crossing the T's and so forth and so on. So let's see here.
Well, thanks very much, Steve.
Okay. Are you going to stick around, Lucas?
Yep, I'll be listening online.
Okay. And you could take a quick look, probably the link there at, if you have any questions, I think you'd have some very good questions if you wanted to see what Jim had written, and I'll be pointing to his paper and other people, too, if they can pull it up, and we'll be going, you know, there are certain questions I've marked page by page, so you certainly and people listening can follow along. And since you're here and maybe some other people, I invite people, they can call in. The number, the guest call-in number is 917-388-4210. 917-388-4210. And I do want to take calls, but we'll talk about the paper first and then look to see if people are calling in. And if not, then maybe we'll turn to my captive call-in guest, meaning Lucas. Okay, fine. Jim, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, the same thing. Rather than just read people your paper, there is a link there that takes them to the abstract, link number 1, deterring fake public participation. We'll take people to the abstract. And, of course, rather than just reading the, they can certainly read the abstract and then click through to the full text of the paper. But can you give us, for those who aren't following online or you know, just listening, can you give us a summary or read your abstract
Sure.
or however you want to put it?
Yeah. First of all, I want to thank you for having me on the program. And I think I'd like to sort of set the stage. I'm a political scientist by training, and we live in a world where democracy has great public legitimacy. Even in authoritarian countries, they often feel required to at least to go through the formalities of an election. And there tends to be all over the world a tendency to claim to be more democratic in practice than in actuality. So you take certain high-profile cases like Russia or Iran or Venezuela that are often criticized in the American press. Putin doesn't say he doesn't believe in a free press. He may create an environment where critical journalists are killed or otherwise disenfranchised, but he doesn't go out and say he doesn't believe in a free press, and he says he believes in elections, and he's gone out of his way to create elections. At the same time, there's a tendency to rig those elections so the outcome is known ahead of time. So we see that process.
Or even in North Korea, where with 99.9% public participation rate in their elections or something like that.
Yeah, Iraq, Saddam Hussein also had elections where he won, you know, with more than 99%. So you have this general phenomenon, and that, of course, doesn't play out in the United States. We don't have that type of fake democracy, but we do have a lot of fake public participation. The government elected officials want to say that they provided an opportunity for the public to participate. It gives their decisions more democratic legitimacy, but they often actually don't have an incentive to create true public participation. The payoff is saying they offered the public that opportunity and the public didn't take it. So with that, I talk about in this paper how we get quite a bit of fake transparency and participation, especially at the local and state level in the United States. I do have some examples from the federal level, but I consider the problem to be worst at the local and state level, partly because at the federal level you have groups like yourself and many other groups that watch the federal government, write about it, and make fake participation at least a little bit more difficult. So, you know, with the Open Government Directive, which I think, you know, is the focus here, you see a little bit of that, where in the definition of high-value data sets, they don't clearly distinguish between data sets that drive accountability versus PR data sets that just further the mission of the agency in some way. So the tendency when you have this type of loose language is to not have accountability driving data made available. So let's see. I could read here the definition of a high-value database in the Open Government Directive, and that is high-value information is information that can be used to increase agency accountability and responsiveness. Okay, so far so good. Improve public knowledge of the agency and its operations. Well, that's fine and legitimate, but that's less oriented to accountability type of information. Further the core mission of the agency. Well, that's pretty vague. That could be a PR type of mission also. Create economic opportunity or respond to need and demand as identified through public consultation. Well, it's pretty vague, and anything that fills any one of those requirements is satisfactory from the standpoint of the Open Government Directive. And I think the databases that have primarily been made available are politically not very controversial. And so I think this is, you know, something to be sensitive to. I think we need a more refined language to distinguish between different types of high-value information from what perspective. There's the accountability perspective that a democratic theorist or a political scientist would care about, but that might be quite different than somebody who is interested in choosing a nursing home or picking a stroller and wants to get information from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, or is a real estate developer and wants information, you know, certain zoning information or whatnot. Those are more service delivery types of transparency, which I care less about.
Well, it certainly, and that raises a good point, because I think a lot of people who are excited about using data want to skip to the end, because certainly, and I believe this, and apparently the administration does too, and the president, that the more you involve the people you're trying to help in how you help them, mm-hmm. and get their feedback, then you'll do a better job. And that probably applies to any kind of relationship, personal or whatever. It's like the better the communication, the better you can help them out. Mm-hmm. And with the idea being that you waste less time doing the wrong thing, and so it's just more effective and efficient way to do things. And so I think a lot of people who, they want to skip to the end part and do the service delivery. Say, oh, I can use this data to come up with a new app on the iPhone, and people can fill in the potholes quicker. And yes, but you kind of skip past the part where the people decide where the road should go or how much money should be spent on roads, and you know that involving the in that extent, as opposed to the simple, you know, spitting out the widgets and filling in the potholes, which is not, you know, just filling in potholes doesn't make us particularly, if we do it quicker or better, doesn't necessarily mean it's a higher quality democracy.
And I think. Now, I want to clarify, you know, where I'm coming from on this is always the perspective of the glass being half full or half empty, and I'm predisposed to focus on the half empty side of the equation on the assumption that there are plenty of other people, including the government agencies themselves, that are more than happy to focus on the half full side. But even though I'm fairly critical of a lot of things that go on transparency, again, especially at the local and state level, the Obama administration has done some extraordinary things to move the ball ahead on public participation and greater transparency. The way that agencies are reaching out, the quality of their websites are dramatically improving. The types of participation, they're experimenting with a lot of different things. And I think the folks at the top of the Obama administration really have the open government and maybe to a little lesser extent public participation religion and have conveyed that to the best of their abilities. The reality, however, is that it's very hard to move 2 million federal workers, you know, who have been there long before the Obama administration and will be there long after, and have maybe a different sensibility about a lot of these issues than the Obama officials. But having said that, you know, the real significant weaknesses in the way that the Obama administration is going about this, the vagueness in which they've defined public participation, the tendency to focus on principles-based disclosure rather than focusing on enforcement. It's wonderful to have these noble goals, but it's a completely different matter to enforce them effectively. And the focus has been on training and education and training and changing the culture regarding secrecy, but until they really address the incentives of the rank and file federal workers who control this information, I think there's going to be a lot of frustration going forward. I don't really see that difficult part of the equation being tackled.
That's the hardest part. It's very easy to tell agencies to release X number of data sets that are high quality, purple, plaid, whatever, and they'll jump through the hoops and do the best. You know, say, you want me to jump? Fine. How high? But if you want them to jump better, then you have to describe what better is. And from what I've seen, they have not defined the criteria for what transparent, participatory, and collaborative are, what their criteria is. And all the bureaucrats want to know is just be clear about how you want me to be more clear, because if it's fuzzy from the top, it's going to be fuzzy at the bottom. And that's one of the things that everything we tell them, and you're right, I agree that they've done a great job, or pretty good, let's say that. They've done a much unprecedented, I think is the term they love to use. Unprecedented, yes, it's been unprecedented level of openness and so forth and so on. That being said, any criticism that people like you and I, and I think 99% of the people who are involved with who want to help them are giving criticism, is in the spirit of constructive criticism. It's simply because we care so much about this, as they do, that we just want to make sure that things don't go awry and don't inadvertently get off track and so forth. And certainly, if that's in the spirit of... seem that if they are open-minded to public input, then they would also be open-minded about public input about how they move forward. So,
No, I think from their perspective, they're going after the low-hanging fruits, the easy things to do. And since the federal government has done such an awful job in making its information transparent and some of their public participation procedures, they're doing the easy stuff first and then leaving the more controversial stuff for later. The worry always is, will they ever get to later after they're done with all the easy, non-controversial data sets? Will they ever get to the more difficult ones when the enthusiasm for this has diminished, this open government directive? So that's an open question, but I think as somebody from the outside, it's our responsibility to keep a focus on the difficult issues as well as the easy ones.
One of the things you wrote about in your paper that I liked was the comparison, even though it's about congressional hearings, the fact that most people who watch a congressional hearing or a snippet or a soundbite or, on TV don't realize, have never sat through one. And so it's all very much very contrived. There's virtually no spontaneity. A little bit, and I think that's what they try to capture on TV, but a lot of times it's being scolded in public, and that people are required to provide their what they're going to say. They have to provide it ahead of time so they can be checked to see if it's okay for them to say that the next day. And you compare it to...
Now, there's an interesting case. Yeah, there's definitely
But I would just say you compare it to a professional wrestling match where it looks like wrestling, but you're wondering if you really, really start to watch, and after a while you realize, hey, we already know where this is going. It's only supposed to look like wrestling and be entertainment.
Yeah.
So,
well, there at the federal level, I actually don't think it's as bad as at the local and state level, where there's much more of a sense that it's first come, first serve, open mic, you can participate freely. At the federal level, at least the public has a sense that the witnesses are invited by members of Congress. But what the public doesn't necessarily have a sense of is that the witnesses have submitted their comments ahead of time, and it's much more tightly scripted. Depends a lot on the committee. It's not true in all committees, but in the committees that I've dealt with, it's fairly tightly scripted. So the members know, what's going on. Often the members will have, when it's say what they're reviewing nominees, they'll have met the person in their office and already asked them all these questions and know what the responses are going to be. And then they'll repeat it again.
Then the congressional members at the very beginning of the hearing will make their speeches about what they think the situation is, and then they have the hearing. So it's like, this is what my opinion about how things are, and oh, by the way, there's some people here to tell me something that I already know, already decided on.
Yeah. Well, the witnesses testify, but the members have generally had access in their staff to the written testimony for at least 24 hours ahead of time, so they know what the presentation is.
But at the same time, I think the comparing it to the federal, there's the Office of Public Engagement in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be the Office of Public Liaison.
Mm-hmm.
And they arrange basically for the town hall meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Or even plain ordinary speeches. If the First Lady goes and gives a speech at a school or at Arlington Cemetery, then that's considered public engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing is, when I first heard that, I'm like, that's not public engagement. But at the same time, I think that, and it's related to your paper too, there's no clear line about public participation and or public engagement. Basically, we're talking about basically about the same thing, but it's a matter of degrees, I guess. So you could argue that the First Lady going and speaking at Arlington Cemetery, did she engage people? Well, in a way, but so I would put that at the lower end of the scale. If it was a town hall meeting where the President or the First Lady were taking questions, then of course that's more, And so I would give it more. So I think when we talk about fake, it's not like a Rolex watch either. It's a Rolex or it's not a Rolex. It, you know, there's no halfway.
There's a desire to have as much control, especially on high stakes public participation. Low stakes doesn't matter. So at the federal level, when you're a presidential candidate and you have one of those, you know, whistle stop, you know, tours that are often covered in local TV or in the newspapers, the tendency is to invite supporters and only notify supporters of where you're going to be. And so it's a favorable audience. Now, it's ostensibly open. Anybody could be there, but it's fairly carefully controlled, and the slots, you know, for the camera positions behind the candidate and whatnot are often very carefully staged. And there's a lot of that in other contexts, like the national conventions. I think the public has a pretty good idea that it's carefully scripted, but they may not know the level of, say, prior restraint that when you go in, you know, they check all of your bags, not just for guns and knives and things like that, but for signage that might run contrary to the message of the candidate. They want everything, all the participation carefully prescripted, but they also want it to look spontaneous on TV. And that's, you know, that's the nature of politics. You want it to look like these are representative of the public and it's open, but at the same time you don't. And I think the public is probably a little bit more sophisticated at a national level because open meetings are more open at a local level. The games that are played to selectively give public notice to allies and not opponents and things like that, or to just have a public meeting and have nobody show up and have it not promoted when it's a controversial issue that you want to pursue, you just are doing it to be able to say that you had a public meeting. You know, I don't think people intuitively know that. They when they go to a couple of these meetings and they discover they're not really being listened to, they're being used, then they don't go back, and it creates this self-defeating spiral where we have all right. these public meetings where nobody participates. And one reason people don't participate is they know they're being used. They're not
right.
really being listened
to. It just creates the cynicism. But what if, how about this? What if, like I said, what if there was a scale from 1 to 10?
Mm-hmm.
And so plain old speeches, you know, just gives a speech, clap, 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 and the president mm-hmm. leaves. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be a 1 or a 2 or somewhere okay. down.
Yeah.
At that end of the scale. And then the more audience participation, the more open it was for people to attend,
mm-hmm.
would get more points. You know, let's just say there's a way to determine how, you know, that there's a sliding scale for open, so it's not just invitation only
mm-hmm.
type of thing, which would be on the lower end. And that, and as the percent of time that people were allowed to ask questions, you know, if it was 50% of the time allotted was for Q&A, then that might be somewhere around a 5, mm-hmm. you know, and so forth. So you had this thing. But then, so if there was a metric then to take the openness, you know, so these criteria, if there was some metric that could combine these three things, you know,
mm-hmm.
then what if there was, they put out a press release, okay, the president's going to have a town hall meeting or whatever, you know, it's like, and it's going to be, we're planning on it being a 5 or something. And then people can say, oh, okay, so it's this. Or if it's going to be by invitation only or something like that, it ends up being a 2 or a 1.
Mm-hmm.
So they would, so that when it was put out there, that either the Office of Public Engagement at a federal agency or at the White House or wherever could let people know that on the scale from 1 to 10, you know, this is going to be a 1 or a 2 or a 7 or an 8. And that way, if you heard it was a 7 or an 8, you'd be like, oh, well, maybe I want to go.
Yeah.
But if it's just going to be a dog and pony show, or, you know, it's just going to be a show, and it's only going to be a 1 or a 2, and I'm just going to, they just expect me to be a an extra clapping in the background, then maybe I don't want to go. But rather than...
Well, that would be great if you could do it. The devil, it would be in the details of how you implement
yeah.
such an index. But, if you could... would be great. Another approach is to not compile it into an index, so that would be the holy grail, but just have some clear criteria, you know,
well,
5 or 6 check boxes.
Yeah. And actually, that's what I'm thinking is that, and I'm is that if they can do it for a meeting, and then say a federal agency has a number of events. Let's say they have 100 events during the course of the year, and then they go back and they check to see, you know, okay, we really had a bunch of twos and threes and so forth and so on, and or whatever, you know, be able to accumulate all the different things that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come up, you know, with a composite score of, okay, well, we've been averaging 4.78. Last year we were 4.63, so, hey, we went up from 4.63 to 4.78.
One question is, who would do it? The agencies would all have a conflict to inflate their openness scores.
Well, it could actually come out to, if you passed, you would actually have to ask, I think, people who attended the events and as an exit poll, just like your customers, how did we do, you know, type of thing, and say, you know, did you understand, was it clear to you what was going on? Were you able to participate? Were you satisfied with the opportunity to participate?
But if the audience is already rigged, like, you know, the way that presidential candidates do it is partly for security reasons and partly for control, and the security reasons are legitimate, they generally often wait to the last minute, and then they notify either the local Democratic or Republican clubs, whichever it might be, or other interest groups that are known allies, and they get the audience there for the candidate. Now, that audience is not going to be critical.
Well,
there are
certainly ways, things to think about, but the idea that you know, so if you, of course, would have to ask people who weren't invited, and it would have to be. But there are ways to take samples of people who attended an event and didn't, you know, and or were kept out. So, but those are details. But I think the idea is that if we come up with some common or criteria, then we can start to begin to talk about ratings and measurement.
Yeah. Well, the criteria are easy. You know, who does it, and how, you know, the details are really difficult. And I think if you ask an observer, most of these things are pretty effectively done. They can't tell to what extent it's rigged. So you can't even ask an impartial person until they know all the processes that were involved.
Well, think, you know, J.D. Powers and Associates, you always see him on TV. We won the J.D. Powers. Now, J.D. Powers does, you know, surveys, customer surveys. You know, did you like your car and customer satisfaction, all that other stuff. And so I think it may have to get to the point where there's outside groups, whether, you know, it's J.D. Powers or other groups that do these type of surveys, to tell that have the that will do it in a way that will be above reproach, because otherwise, if it looks like they're being bought and paid for by their customers, then nobody will believe that that it's truly objective information. So we'll see how it goes. But I think we won't try to figure out the details at this point. At this point, the Open Government Directive does not have criteria other than transparency, participation, and collaboration, and it's like, okay, so what? How do you get your arms around that? How do you get a handle on what
is? It's very vague. I think they should have many more subcategories. Like, I often go crazy. I cover education policy, and people talk about accountability all the time. And then the question is, well, who's being made accountable? The parents, the teachers, the school system, the kids? What the elected officials? There often is very vague talk. You don't really know what they're talking about, and I think the current approach is like that. I wonder if the word transparency is just too general to get. It overlooks these very important distinctions, but it is a nice catchphrase.
Well, the thing is, but it'll get so abused that it'll become meaningless if it becomes right now, I think it is, in large part, a Rorschach test.
Mm-hmm.
It's whatever anybody wants to see in it.
Mm-hmm.
And who's against transparency? You know, it's kind of like, who's against...
Nobody's against transparency.
Yeah, so it's an easy word to throw out, because the politicians can throw it out because they know that it could mean anything to anybody and so forth. But Sunlight Foundation, for instance, wants people to sign a pledge and get their friends to sign a pledge saying that they want transparency in their elected officials, and that they're going to hold those officials accountable for being transparent. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, well, what do you mean by that? You know, how will people decide? And they say, oh, they'll figure it out for themselves. Their main thing was just to get people to sign a pledge so they could say, you know, X number of people signed our pledge, and whoop-de-doo, we're all excited about transparency and so forth. But, I mean, if it's just meaningless, then it becomes, it actually is worse.
Well, from a marketing perspective, you do have to keep things very simple. That's unfortunately...
Yeah. Not too simple.
if you get into the details, but I think when it comes to elected officials and transparency, most people immediately think of accountability driving information. So, for example, the White House lobbying disclosure, that got incredible attention, completely disproportionate to the overall open government directive in the press, because that was viewed as real accountability driving information. But I think it's more the exception than the rule in the way this open government directive that's what's highlighted, but I don't think it's representative of what's really coming out in these data sets. I think we both agree with that.
And one thing in your paper, I think, let's see, this is, you had mentioned, as I'm looking at, I guess this is page 99, item number 4, you talk about metadata, and I kind of jumped out, public policy recommendations, and metadata, of course, is not a word people use most of the time, but basically, it's, as you explain here, it's information about what's going on. So that if, for instance, like we were just talking about a little while ago, if there is going to be an event or a process, a policy decision-making process, and the public's going to be involved, then it describes, it says, okay, here's what we're going to do. First, we're going to let out, you know, it's going to be open, it's going to be a town hall meeting, and it's going to be Q&A, and that'll take up, you know, the second half of the program, and people will be able to get tickets, or admission will be open, and it describes exactly, you know, what people should, what's going to happen, as opposed to just, hey, town hall meeting, show up, you know, that type of thing. So
yeah. Now, when NextGov wrote up this essay, that's the section they focused on, the metadata, and most people, you know, when they think about a meeting, they don't think about all the characteristics that went on before and after the meeting and determine the structure of the meeting. For example, the steps taken to publicize a meeting, I would argue that should be part of the public record. So if they publicize a special meeting by taking out 2 classified ads in the public newspaper that nobody reads, they're way in the back pages and there's small print, and that's what's called giving public notice, as part of the record for the meeting, it could note that that's how the public notice requirement was filled. Now, I've been to many, when I want to find out about a public meeting, I have to beg the officials to let me know, because I don't go read through all the small print in my local classified ads, the legal notices and public notices in my newspaper. I have a life. So they, I gave an example here where Congress requires, when they do the PEG funding for local public educational and government access channels, they have to do a needs assessment. And they have to have 2 public meetings. My county fulfills that by taking out 2 obscure ads. And, you know, I begged them to let me know I want to go to that meeting. And they didn't call me back and let me know. It should be part of the record that that's how they went about promoting. And I have, you know, perhaps a dozen things. When they put up, you know, the notice to speak, it should be clear, is it a first-come, first-serve? Is it stacked ahead of time? Exactly when is it posted? So that often, you know, the first 10 people somehow have a particular point of view. If there's the public body senses it could be controversial, and then a certain dynamic gets created. You know, as long as these things are clearly stated, you know, that's
right up,
fine,
right,
and the public can judge it, and that should just be part
right
of the record.
Yeah, right up front, though. It should be right up front. Before you go into the, you know, before you get involved in something, you want to know ahead of time, okay, before I go to this meeting, what's the process? What am I getting myself involved in, and how long will it take? And you know,
And then one thing I really care a lot about is the way the public record is done. Is it going to be accessible? Is it going to be tied in some official's office, so you have to go ask the secretary?
Yeah.
Cost a lot. Will there be any, most of these public meetings you can speak and there's no record of a meaningful record at all of what you've done, and you don't really have an opportunity to submit anything in the public record that's in any way meaningfully public and whatnot. All that should be clearly specified.
And exactly, the open government plans that's one thing I would ask people to keep an eye out for is when you're looking at these open government plans and they talk about all the wonderful things they're going to do about this, that, and the other thing, it's like, where's the part, and it should be right up front, where's the part that describes, there was a presidential memorandum, and then there was, a directive, and now we're doing this, and so forth and so on, and now we've just issued this open government plan in order to do all the things we're supposed to do, and now looking to the future, these are our milestones. This is, now we're going to do this, and then after that we're going to do this, and there will be a record here, and a website there, and, points of contact, and all that information should be so that we're not looking into the future and it's foggy, because they're making it up, because, as you probably said, a lot of places have just been making it up as they go along. But now this is an opportunity, I think, to be a model for state and local ones where they can say, okay, here's the things, here's the metadata, the Uber information about the public participation event or opportunity that and hopefully they can all be the same across the government, so you're not, it's not 27 different flavors of websites and metadata, and so you go.
Yeah, so this is another way of getting at your idea of an index. These would be the micro ingredients, the metadata, to put together an overall assessment. And then there's always the distinction between what is said and what actually happened. So that can be a problem. But I think this type of metadata about public participation would go a long way to the type of accountability that you were talking about with some type of summary as to what was really going on.
And one other thing that I wanted people to, we're coming up, I should say, if anybody wants to call in, we still have a few minutes here, if there are people listening.
Welcome Lucas's feedback. He's, very...
Well, actually, it looked, I'm not sure if he's... whether he's still on the line. I got to take a look here on the control panel. He said he was listening, but if you are listening, Lucas, and if you have any questions, then certainly call back in. But the call-in number for anybody is... 917-388-4210, and we're talking with Jim Snyder and the paper that he published about deterring fake public participation. And I'm Steve Buckley, your host at Open Government Radio and opengovernmentradio.com. And the thing that with these open government plans coming out, I would point out, we were talking about measures, and there was one link I had pointed out to Andrea DiMaio. Is a pretty, in my opinion, he's on my blog roll as far as somebody worth reading about as far as the open government plans go. He works for the Gartner Group. But he has link number three on ustransparency.com for today. He has a link to his blog on what government plans are missing, and he mentions the fact that the ones he's seen in draft form are missing the measures part. And if you look in the Open Government Directive, it only asks for measures. I mean, because really, how can you tell if you're doing it any better if you don't have some kind of yardstick, even a flawed yardstick, but some yardstick for measuring whether or not you're making any progress. But I would just say to people that there is actually a, if you look in the Open Government Directive, under 3 in the appendix, or the attachment, I guess, it's 3D, under flagship initiative. It says that agencies are supposed to come up with a flagship initiative, which would be like a model for all the other things. But it says, say, under that, 3D, subparagraph 4, they must provide an account of how your agency plans to measure improved transparency, participation, and collaboration. So even though it's kind of a back doorway, it's there. And so agencies are required to put something in their plan when in describing their, and you'll look under the flagship initiative, but it should be something there. And the ones I've seen a couple, and they're not there. And to me, that's
so I want to just highlight. We only got a few minutes. Distinction
that
I'm making.
I just want to make people understand that that there are critical aspects to these plans that they can't, they will not work. Just like your car won't work if a wire's not attached.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are critical aspects, and that's the one. If I would say to anybody, if they're gonna don't read the whole plan, just look for that part. Where's the measures? And also the metadata, too. So go ahead, Jim. What were you going to ask?
Yeah, the distinction between retrospective and prospective public participation. Most of the people in this public participation community focus on prospective participation, which is if you're a lobbyist or an activist, you want to be able to participate before a decision is made, and that's the priority. Retrospective participation is the linkage between the participation and the transparency communities, is a record after the fact of the participation. And that's very important because it makes the speech much more costly. I go to all these meetings where there's no record afterwards. So we have prospective participation, but not retrospective participation. And participation is very important because it gives you a sense later on of what information was available to the decision makers when they made the decision and if they ignored important information. And at the next election, if it turns out they made the wrong decision and there was participation giving them good information and they ignored it, then the cost of ignoring it goes way up and it makes the prospective participation actually more meaningful. It has more of a consequence. So a lot of folks just focus on the prospective side and tend to downplay the retrospective side. I think they're vital and they're closely linked, and I hope the dialogue and deliberation community will, going forward, focus just like more on metadata about participation, more on retrospective participation as an important type of participation in policy deliberations.
Well, I agree because they actually should be. If you look at the International Association for Public Participation's core values, the idea is that when you involve people, you tell them how their feedback affected your decision.
Mm.
And I would look for that in these plans too, to see, just like when federal regulations are finalized. They put it in the Federal Register, and then they explain how they took the comments and how it shaped the final product, even in a general sense. They still will talk about, some people said this, some people said that, so we decided to write it this way. And I would look in the plans to see if they actually take how they can link all the ideas they got from people and what they did with them, or if they just ignored them.
Yeah, well, if you want people to participate, the sense that it may make a difference is important. But what I have in mind when I think of retrospective participation is not this requirement to explain how the rules evolve from the participation, but just so third parties can evaluate whether the press and opinion leaders in the community can, if a decision later proves to be highly faulty, they can go back and see whether that was based on reasonable information at the time or whether something else was going on and they were ignoring the information that would have led to a different and better decision. So it is slightly different than those type of guidelines. And that doesn't mean in any way disagree with them, but I'm talking about something a bit different.
Okay. Well, I guess we're going to have to call it there for today. We've got a few seconds left. Thanks, Jim Snyder, for coming on. You can read more about what Jim's involved in by going to his website, which is isolon.org. I did put a link at U.S. Transparency there, but it's isolon.org. Did I spell that right?
Yep.
Okay. And next week, of course, we'll be talking about all the open government plans that will come out. I have put an open invitation to people from the White House who are working on these things to come on to the program. So we'll see if they accept that. And this is Steve Buckley, and thanks again for listening to Open Government Radio. And we'll see you next week. Thanks. Bye.